You're listening to The Martial Brain, the podcast that explores the intersection between the martial arts, science, critical thinking, skepticism, and that wacky organ that floats inside our skull in a pool of cerebrospinal fluid, making life unpredictably inspiring, infuriating, and sometimes just batshit crazy. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. The Power of Doubt, The Martial Arts, Critical Thinking, and Skepticism, Part 2. My early martial arts career was a roller coaster ride from one extreme to another. I spent the first 4 or 5 years decidedly not pursuing excellence. Why not? The answer is that my self-image held me back. I was absolutely convinced that I was, quote, not athletic, unquote. That it was literally not possible for me to improve my level of performance, no matter how hard I worked. So why did I continue to train with an attitude like that? Well, I'm not sure, but through some stroke of luck, I did, even though I was by far the least proficient martial artist in my group. I suppose I stuck with it because the efficiency and, yes, the outright coolness of martial arts techniques always appealed to the superhero-crazed nerd in me. I loved being around people who were practicing the martial arts. It's simply that I was absolutely convinced that I personally could never become proficient at them. Eventually, after years of drifting along with this attitude, and despite having put myself at such a mental and emotional disadvantage, I came to the absolutely astonishing realization that I was indeed barely becoming at least somewhat proficient. Eureka! Once I saw that progress was possible, even for me, I realized that I could increase the rate of my improvement if I attacked training with a vengeance, instead of with my previous playful but negative attitude. By the time another 4 or 5 years had passed, I had developed a pretty good skill set and could hold my own at sparring with just about anyone in my immediate geographic area. As you might guess, one of the results of my rapid improvement was a massive explosion of cocky egotism. The way I did the martial arts worked really well for me, and I was not inclined to change anything or to be easily convinced to learn something new. Neither my overly negative self-image at the beginning of my career or my overblown ego after 10 years were useful mindsets. Had I only understood the weaknesses of the human brain in the way I'm beginning to understand them now, perhaps I could have avoided a great many mistakes. It also would have helped a great deal to have learned effective critical thinking skills and to have developed a grasp of scientific skepticism much earlier in my life. Last week, I did my best to begin to describe for you what skepticism is and some reasons why I think it's important. I talked about metacognition, which is the skill of thinking about what you are thinking and why you are thinking it. I also discussed how skepticism is a set of tools for helping you to evaluate truth claims which other people might make. But when we do arrive at the conclusion that something is true, what exactly does that mean? Does it mean that it's true in the metaphysical sense? In other words, not just beyond all reasonable doubt, but beyond all possible doubt, and never subject to change in the future? No, it doesn't, at least not in the context I'm using here. Is it necessary to know things to a perfect certainty? Of course not. These are the kind of questions that the philosophical discipline of epistemology deals with all the time. Don't be intimidated by the big word. Epistemology is the field of studying, among other things, how we know what we know. In the real world, scientists and skeptics work with models of reality. Models don't need to be perfect. They just need to work often enough to be useful. Fortunately, the models developed through the scientific method work vastly more often than that low standard. A good example of this is the body of knowledge developed by Sir Isaac Newton more than 300 years ago. He described laws of motion and gravity that hugely advanced our understanding of how the real world works. These laws formulated a powerful new model of a large part of our reality. But were Newton's laws of motion and gravity true in a philosophical sense, irrevocable and unchangeable? As it turned out, no. About 100 years ago, Albert Einstein unveiled his ideas about time, space, and gravity in his theories of relativity. After Einstein, all of Newton's laws still applied perfectly in the world in which you and I live, meaning at the scale, gravity, and speeds with which humans are familiar. But once you shrink down to the world of subatomic particles, Newton's laws fall completely apart. When titanic amounts of gravity, like those near a black hole, white dwarf, or pulsar, come into play, Newton's laws no longer apply. For an object moving at a significant fraction of the speed of light, Newton's laws become nearly meaningless. Does this mean that Newton was wrong? Well, the answer to that is yes and no. More importantly, does it mean that all of the technology which resulted from our new understanding of Newton's laws needed to be rethought or even scrapped? Of course not. All of those technological advances operate on the Newtonian scale and still work nicely. Is it possible to know anything to the absolute philosophical standard? Many people might answer yes to this question. But from a skeptical and scientific standpoint, the answer is no. Those who do insist that it's possible to know something absolutely beyond all doubt are actually referring to belief rather than knowledge. Knowing the difference between belief and knowledge is half the battle. As humans, we respect certainty. To us, uncertainty almost smacks of moral weakness. I suspect that this is because our desire for certainty is in our DNA. For our distant ancestors, uncertainty frequently resulted in a quick death. This innate desire for certainty is one of the reasons we are drawn so powerfully to belief rather than to research. I have my own history of blind belief. Remember the description of my early martial arts career? During the first 4 or 5 years, I really believed that I could not improve my physical skills. After 10 years, I really believed that my skill set and knowledge were at a level that justified making snap judgments about other martial arts and artists. Now, it's not my intention here today to quibble with the concept of belief, or with people's beliefs in general. It's simply the case that by its very nature, belief is frequently outside the framework of scientific discussion and debate. A claim based on scientific theory is testable and potentially disprovable. A claim based on belief is frequently and conveniently not testable, and thus not disprovable. Such claims are better left to theologians and philosophers. So for the purposes of advancing scientific knowledge and technology, we must maintain a strict standard of understanding the difference between belief and the working model of reality that we refer to as knowledge. In the world of science, the word fact is often misused. There is technically no such thing as a scientific fact. No matter how much evidence we gather, and no matter how successful any branch of science has become, we must always leave room for new discoveries and new knowledge. When we do discover new knowledge, it often forces us to revise our earlier models of reality. But this very fact paralyzes some people into inaction. If our knowledge isn't perfect, why do we proceed with any important project? Why not wait until we have perfect knowledge before we engage in any action? But that kind of thinking, making the perfect the enemy of the good, would have left us as a species still dodging predators near the bottom of the food chain. For a sensibly skeptical scientist, or the sensibly skeptical martial artist, or for any sensible skeptic, it's unimportant whether or not we know, with a capital K, anything to an absolute certainty. What is important is that we work with the best model available based on what research and observation has taught us to date. it's almost surely the truth that most, if not all, of these working models are functional, but not perfect. History shows that this non-perfect system works pretty damned well. Another thing that humans seem to have is a genetic affinity for stubborn refusal to change one's mind. As a matter of fact, we refer to politicians who change their mind as flip-floppers. We prefer our leaders to display a demeanor of certitude. If the leader of your band of hunter-gatherers, or of your small military group, does not display certitude, morale within the group tends to suffer. And that doesn't bode well for your future. But in the modern world, with its complexity and nuance, the ability to change one's mind when presented with new evidence is vital. It's one of the most important tools we have in advancing the frontiers of knowledge. Okay, just how did we gain what little knowledge that we do know? For more than the first 99% of our 200,000-year existence as a species, the going was slow indeed when it came to developing useful working models of the universe. We only developed effective critical thinking skills in the last 2,000 years or so. Even today, the vast majority of people never learn these skills, or at least seldom actually use them. Only when we begin to understand that our cognitive weaknesses and biases stand in the way of progress were we able to learn to allow for and control for these weaknesses in our observations and experiments. That led to the modern scientific method, which is still evolving and improving. Intellectual laziness is in our genes. We are far more likely to accept and believe what we hear from stories, which takes very little effort, than to actually make the effort to go out and learn for ourselves, the much more difficult path of research. To overcome this cognitive flaw, we must put on our big primate pants and accept the uncertainty of a working model that is based on observation and evidence. A wise man once said, "Everything I know, I owe to my ignorance." What did he mean by this? It means to accept that we don't already have all the answers, and still have much to learn. You can learn a lot about a person by the way they react to the concept of ignorance. Some people are actually proud of being ignorant. You might hear them say something like, "I don't know anything about that, and I don't want to know anything about it." Other people are ashamed of being ignorant. While this is a more useful attitude, you can only learn so much in your lifetime, so shame is not entirely appropriate. So long as you are actively learning all your life, you should not feel ashamed of what you are ignorant of when you die. A skeptic looks at ignorance as an opportunity, kind of like a hard drive with a lot of empty space to fill. Ongoing education is the lifeblood of a good skeptic. But again, with nearly unlimited potential knowledge, combined with a limited lifespan, you can't personally research everything yourself. While there's nothing more satisfying than doing your own research, is there an acceptable substitute for those occasions when you can't? Yes. It's called expert opinion. While a skeptic should never blindly accept anyone's claims, he or she should give serious extra weight to the working models of the universe developed by experts in their own fields. This is sometimes referred to as scientific consensus. Without the power of scientific consensus, we could never use our ability to function together as social creatures as a tool to advance knowledge. We would only ever progress as far as any one individual can progress in the pursuit of universal knowledge. So if you realize that there's an area you want to know something about, but don't have the time, energy, or money to research yourself, open a book or get online and start finding out what the experts think. Check multiple sources. When you find a common thread among dozens of different sources, you're beginning to get closer to the current consensus. Getting back to ignorance, it's not a weakness or a failing to say to someone, "I don't know." A good, knowledgeable, competent martial arts instructor should never be afraid to utter those words. He or she should also not be afraid to utter the words, "Let's do some research." As a martial artist, I can't imagine anything more fun than either literally or figuratively putting on a white belt and learning something new, improvement in methods of fighting have probably been developing, disappearing, and redeveloping for our entire 200,000 years as a species. For most of those years, I'm sure the progress was slow. We had not yet developed writing to record the discoveries, or the scientific method and critical thinking skills to improve on them. In the last 5,000 years, many great advances have been made in the martial arts, resulting in a number of amazing styles that developed fantastic techniques. The archaeological record is, of course, spotty, but I'm sure that these last 5,000 years of development far outstripped any development before that. But, in my opinion, the advances made in the martial arts in the last 3 centuries, and especially since the end of World War II, dwarf the advances made in all of history up to that point. Do you notice a parallel with the timeline of events in human science and technology? I ascribe these advances in the martial arts to mixing the philosophies of the East and West and adding in a good strong dose of scientific skepticism. In the modern world, techniques that don't work drop away quickly. The growth of both the internet and mixed martial arts in the 1990s was one of the greatest shots in the arm for the development of martial arts in history. Don't get me wrong, MMA has lots of problems. There are plenty of martial riddles that it has not helped to solve. Many techniques that work well for military special operators do not work well in the cage, and vice versa. But even with those arguments aside, from my perspective as a martial artist who has been training since 1971, the level of the average young martial artist in 2016 is far better than the level of the average young martial artist in 1975. People like Jigoro Kano, Don Draeger, Bruce Lee, Jun Ri, Dan Inosanto, and the Gracie family have all had a huge influence on this explosive improvement. So has modern skepticism. It gives us the tools to help outgrow our intellectual laziness and incuriosity, just as we need to outgrow our other less than useful instincts, like racism and cruelty. This ends part 2 of The Power of Doubt. Anyway, that's what I think. But I could be wrong. Let me know what you think at my website, rpmartialarts.com. I'm Jeff Westfall for The Martial Brain. The Martial Brain is produced by Raging Squirrel Productions in association with the Rising Phoenix Martial Arts Academy. If you like the podcast and would like to help it grow, go to iTunes or Stitcher and give it an honest rating and review. Contact me with questions about the Martial Brain or the Rising Phoenix Academy at our website, rpmartialarts.com.